You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
Welcome to today's episode. Today, I'm joined by Aidan McLaughlin from Indeed.com. Aidan has one of the most interesting and unique titles, at least that I've ever heard in the world of brand and marketing. We'll get to that in a bit. A lot of people have probably heard of Indeed.com, but Aidan, great to have you on the show. Why don't you just start by telling us, what is a global director of ESG brand? And do you know anyone else in the world that even has that title?
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited for the conversation. I believe there'll be more ESG brand directors as we move into this future where organizations have to be conscious of the impact they're having on society, the environment, and the way businesses are run will have an impact on equity in the world. And my role at Indeed is to both look at the ESG commitments we've made as an organization and ensuring that we're telling that story to the world and both internally and externally and to our stakeholders outside of the organization. But Indeed has made this bold commitment to helping 30 million job seekers facing barriers get hired by 2030. And my job is to figure out how do we infuse that mission into our brand work, but also what are the brand levers we can pull to help more people who face barriers get hired. So it's fascinating work. It's incredibly nuanced. The more you learn about these barriers, whether it's people with criminal records, disability, people who don't have college degrees, veterans, the more you realize you don't know anything and you're starting fresh. And that's incredibly challenging. And I always felt in all of the roles I've had, as long as you're learning, you're in a good place.
So is it semantics then? So if someone's listening to this, oh, that's not new. I've got someone in my organization who has a CSR title or has an impact title. Is there something important or significant about the specifics of your role at Indeed and what that title represents that's different?
Well, I think one, it's the measurement piece. There's a very clear measurement attached to that. And like the OKR of helping 4 million people a year facing barriers get hired and tying my impact to those goals is incredibly important. I think the semantics will change. I mean, ESG, I think the exciting thing about ESG is that it's what investors are looking for brands to and companies to show their ESG work and they're willing to invest in that. And you have a bit of a backlash that's emerging, but really the arc of progress is towards organizations being clear about the impact they're having on the world and that they are the companies that will win out in the future. And I firmly believe that. And so the more I can do from a brand standpoint to help Indeed tell that story and meet those ambitious goals, so that's where I want to be with my work.
I think maybe what's interesting about it isn't so much the title itself, but it's where you sort of live within the org structure. I think in a lot of other organizations, I'd love to hear from you because you're probably a lot closer to this, people who are in that CSR or impact role don't necessarily come in in marketing or in that brand role. They're adjacent to it. Would you agree with that? And does that matter?
No, I think that's right. Like in my role, I'm very much partnered with our social impact team. So I meet with them daily, understand what they're doing on the ground, what they're doing in the US, what they're doing globally. And then working with our product teams. And one of the things we're doing, we have heavy product backing to come up with equitable hiring solutions within the product. And so that's fascinating work. And then me sitting in marketing, I can advocate for budget for these programs and understanding how budget gets allocated, how to talk to the business, how to influence leadership to ensure that not only are these programs supported from a social impact point of view, but like, how do we influence all of our marketing to reflect the work that we're doing from an ESG and values perspective? And that's both in the type of stories we tell, who gets to tell those stories, who's the director on a commercial spot? Who are the actors that we choose? How do we ensure that there's true representation in front of the lens, behind the lens, but also in the agencies we work with, making sure that we're looking at underrepresented minorities being part of our agency mix and businesses owned and operated by underrepresented minorities being part of our agency suite, and always challenging the business to think about, are we selecting the agencies based on the merits, or is it just because I've worked with that agency before and I'm coming into my new agency? There's a lot of that that goes on, and a lot of budget is spent in that way. And I have the remit to interrogate and ensure that there's a balance to be struck there from an equitable lens.
Yeah, because coming from that side of the fence, we've seen a huge uptick in when we're involved in new opportunities and having to address those things with rigor. Luckily, we'd started our program before the big change started to happen, but it's critical now. You can't just get away with having platitudes. You really have to be committed to a program.
Sure. Yeah, it's really important work.
Just take a step back a second. Just remind us again, give us a quick background on Indeed, because many people might have heard of it, might just think of it as a jobs or recruitment website, but give us a bit more of a background on Indeed for the uninitiated.
Yeah, so Indeed is one of the world's largest job matching platform. We bring over 300 million job seekers to the marketplace for jobs with employers. We also have one of the largest databases of company reviews and salary databases in the world. So really, it's where the world goes to get jobs, essentially.
Okay. And what I find really interesting is with the type of role that you're in being relatively new in a lot of organizations, it's interesting seeing how varied the background is of people who come into this role. So maybe talk about your early career, how it shaped you. Like, what was the trajectory that brought you into a role of being the global director of ESG brand?
And well, we had met earlier and I gave you some of the brief, but I thought about it more deeply. And really, I left Ireland in 1999 to go to university in the States. And I went to the US on a scholarship, a swimming scholarship. And I think that was the biggest moment that changed my career trajectory, because I was shifted out of Irish society and the way Irish people think about the world, and landed in Ohio into the Midwest of America, and was confronted with an entirely different reality, a much more diverse population, a American idea and an American story that at times was jarring. Someone once said that if the Americans spoke a different language, you would realize how different a country it is. Sometimes you think just because it's English speaking, it's like the UK or Ireland, and it was entirely different. And I was incredibly homesick the first year. I wanted to go back to Ireland with the tail between my legs, but I forced myself to stay. And I ended up spending 6 years in the States, and I was studying psychology in college. But what really fascinated me was I used to drive a lot around Ohio because it's such a massive state. And I listened to AM radio a lot. And it was the first time I ever had encountered politics as entertainment. So you had a lot of right-wing radio stations, and they were incredibly disciplined with talking points. Like, the things you would hear on the morning show on the radio would end up being the same talking points on Fox News that evening. And to me, there was something just fascinating about that story discipline. And whether or not the politics were entirely different to my own, but I was fascinated to understand more and understand the why behind that type of work. And so I found myself entering into public relations and understanding mass communications and persuasion and corporate communications, and began working in Ogilvy in Chicago, and then came back to Ireland, spent years in PR, joined Indeed very early on in the organization. So 10 years ago, where we were only 800 people, we're 15,000 now globally, and set up a PR function for Indeed, which again was in all of it, operating PR functions in different countries and different markets, as to the UK, to France, Germany, Japan, Singapore, Australia. And again, it was just this diving into cultural nuance and understanding how to tell Indeed story to different cultures at different times, and getting it wrong a lot of the time, but also understanding sometimes how to capture the news agenda in a country with whether it's data or story. So that was the beginning, and then moved out of that role into a storytelling role, which I kind of created alongside the previous CMO, Paul Darcy. And that got into storytelling that infused our values. So telling the stories of job seekers who got a job on Indeed and how it changed their lives. And I think then the organization saw that there was a way we could tell our story that had deep cultural resonance through different platforms, whether it's podcasting, film, sort of online video, and sort of explore that. And then the opportunity this year came up to do that in a deeper, more programmatized way on the ESG side of things. So that's a long-winded way of explaining the story, but I think it comes back to like persuasion at the core was the thing that's always fascinated me.
One of the things I found really interesting about US society is that there are aspects, there's a contradiction sometimes. So there are certain roles in which you can just show up and call yourself an expert. Like I could just show up and say, I'm an expert. I'm a storytelling expert. And no one's going to say, well, show me your diploma and certificate. Mm. Interestingly, if you want to be an interior designer, you actually need to be licensed, because if you choose the wrong color of pink, that could be very dangerous. But for storytelling, that isn't the case. And I think because of that, it gets very overused. And a lot of people maybe who don't understand storytelling feel qualified to talk about storytelling. In your mind, if storytelling was something that you needed a certification for in order to be approved, what would those skills and qualities, like how would you have to sort of prove that you are an accredited storyteller, if you will, in your mind?
So I go back. So one of the things that I took on a number of years ago is just to find as many reference points for storytelling as possible. I think it was a book by Will Storr, The Science of Storytelling, that kind of set me off on my journey, but also Into the Woods by John York, who set up the BBC Writers Academy. And it appears to me that you would both have to take writing courses, whether that's screenwriting, script writing. So you'd have to take literature and understand the structure of story as it is best understood. But I also think then you would have to take psychology courses. You would have to understand how people operate in the world. And that would take in some behavioral science, I would imagine. And then you would have to understand how the brain works. And so that you would have to have some underpinnings in neuroscience. And I think there's plenty more that you could take on, whether it's anthropology,
religious studies.
Yes, absolutely. When you think about the greatest stories ever told are always coming from that spiritual bent. So you would structure a course that would have all of those components. And probably we should do that, because one of the things that holds us back as professionals in this space is the lack of a professional accreditation. But if you think about story as a technology, it's the oldest technology we have for moving society in a direction. The idea of persuasion, the idea of reasoning with groups is not necessarily to get to the correct answer, but it's to get to the answer that most people agree with. So we have to understand story, both the stories we tell ourselves, but also the stories that others tell themselves. And it's within the meeting of those two things that we can get the most amount of people to move in the direction we need them to move.
How important is it as someone who would be accredited, if you will, inside your own organization when you're meeting with others to upskill them on some of these aspects? Like, do you see that as a general gap even internally? How important is it that more people, and not just in marketing or brand, but across other parts of the organization, understand this?
I mean, one of the things I've done for a long time within Indeed is offer up a storytelling training, facilitating. And that's across HR, sales, CS, legal, product, just to get the components of this. Because I think at all times in an organization, whether we're trying to get budget for our projects or to update leadership on a project, we have to craft a story. And so often we get obsessed with what we're trying to say and we forget to think about the listening of the people we're trying to persuade. And so I've offered that up for years. And I think that has helped the organization move in a direction around storytelling. But also, invariably, you're working with senior leaders and they're in the weeds of their work and forget sometimes that there's a bigger narrative out there in the world and that they may be SVP of XYZ, but an average audience at a conference that they're speaking to don't think of them at that, and they have to earn their credibility and authenticity. And that comes from getting back to these basic components. And it's like Bob Iger said, a great story well told is a miracle and it's not an accident. I think that you have to get back to the core components of what a great story is. And really, there's three things to that, right, Gabriel? There's a beginning, a middle, and end. And then there's change over time. And we forget, we're so obsessed with the here and now. I think that's a modern obsession that we forget that there's a history and that people need to see a future vision if they're going to buy into what you're saying.
So you said, maybe you started to touch on it, but can you double click just a little bit on when you do this training internally, what are the sort of core components? Like, is it a 2-hour thing, a 4-hour thing? How do you sort of structure it internally?
So generally I try to do a 2-hour theoretical deep dive. So it takes into these components of like script writing, what makes a great story from a scripting point of view, what are the essence of a great film? And usually I focus in on things like The Shawshank Redemption or the things that people always show up on people's sort of best film lists. But then somewhat just introducing some of these ideas from neuroscience, like the idea of mirror neurons, which are these pieces in our brain that light up when we see someone else getting hurt, the same neurons in our brain light up. And that's why we feel empathy, and sort of introducing some of these neuroscience elements. And then putting it into a practical framework that people can go away and start crafting their own stories with. So how do you start off with your beginning, your thesis, then confronting it with its opposite, the antithesis, and then synthesizing, like just giving people really practical frameworks that they can both use for a podcast interview or for a presentation in front of thousands of people.
Feeling incredibly under pressure right now. Do you find that you get to see really sort of who leans into it based on people who might loop back with you afterward and say, hey, I was trying out what you talked about. Will you take a look at it? Like, does that happen? How frequent does that happen?
Invariably, there are people today who are reaching out to me, contacting me, sorry, using that Americanism, but like contacting me to revisit some of the theory and to work with them on, especially if they've got big presentations come up. Somebody who I may have talked to a year and a half ago in the organization will ping me and say, hey, I've got a promotion coming up. Can you help me put the case together? So I think it's sort of established. And I think if anyone is working in their organization, it's a really valuable thing to offer up your expertise to people who are not in your discipline area, because it establishes you as a mentor for the organization, but also gives you, for me, the reason I'm in Indeed 10 years is I've deep relationships across all areas of the business. And that came from, you know, if you go back to storytelling, me telling a story that I'm available for support and for guidance around this thing that is core to every role. I think that's the amazing thing. You sit in the marketing, you're sort of a storytelling person, but in reality, everybody is trying to get their story across. And so it becomes a foundational principle of getting ahead in your career. And I think the best CEOs, and Chris Heim is the CEO of Indeed, I've been working with him and on a podcast ever since we all went home because of the pandemic. We've been doing this. It was a weekly podcast about what was happening in the organization as a result of the pandemic. He's a great communicator and storyteller. And that's how you get an organization as big as 15,000 people to move in a direction and maintain a focus on the values that you set out. Yeah. So I think it's really important.
It's a great career learning as well. Just the initiative then that you took, I imagine that then you came up with the idea, you then approached, I don't know, whether your training team or HR to start this, right? No one came to you and said, hey, Aidan, why don't we start a storytelling course?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it just comes from a deep love of learning. I think that was the things that sort of has driven me in my career is again, like if you're learning in your role, if you're excited about the things, the material that you're consuming, and then you're sharing with others and you're having impact on them, like there's nothing better you could really ask for in your career.
I found that sometimes the best way to solidify your own individual learning and expertise is actually by teaching. I found that the moments mm-hmm. where I've had to organize something and teach a class, whether it's internally or some, or go into a class at college or MBA, are sometimes the moments that really solidify your learning when you have to teach something, whatever role you're in.
It also clarifies your thinking. If you have to sit down, distill what you understand about the subject matter for somebody else to consume, you quickly see where your logical flaws are. If you're plotting out a course, you really see, okay, that doesn't connect to the next point. And so it's a discipline in doing that as well, which also helps your ability to communicate with others and to work through the ideas that you have. You know, marketing, there are so many theories out there. There's the work of Peter Field and Les Benet and Karen Nelson Field, Orlando Wood, you've Mark Ritson. They're all coming up with principles for marketing. And then if you expand your remit to these other areas where you have people, media scholars like Neil Postman or script writing theorists or storytelling theorists like Will Storr, it's combining all those areas to see, is there a common thread that can help me think about things slightly differently? And I think storytelling is about, can we see the way we view the world through a different lens? And when I think about equity in storytelling, there's a quote by a teacher and thinker in the US, Dr. Rudine Sims, and she says that people need mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. And the mirrors to see themselves in, windows to look into the worlds of others, and sliding glass doors to step in and experience those other worlds. And I think that changes how you see the world when you're exposed to different stories from different perspectives by different types of people. And that's where true empathy can come from. And that's how you can help more people get jobs in my circumstance.
Every so often in these conversations, I hear a new term that I hadn't heard before. And there's a word that you said earlier, which is the idea of story discipline. Talk about what that is, what it means, and why it's important. I mean, it's obvious. Okay, this story discipline is having the same speaking points and being consistent, but go deeper into that, because I think it's something that we often forget and discount.
So story discipline is a simplicity, but also it's incredibly complex, I would say. And so when I think about telling a story, story is about change over time. And we have to think about the discipline to understand what is our beginning, like what is the thesis of our story? What are we setting out to say? And then the change, the exploration of the world as it is a better way of explaining that. And then you talk about script writing as the inciting incident. What moves you from this act one, this beginning, to the middle, where we test our knowledge? You know, in script writing, we think about, you know, confronting this truth with its opposite. It's where the monster comes out of the cave and attacks the village. And so that's interrogating the world as we see it. And in the great stories, the monster turns out not to be evil, but there's some reason it's acting the way it is. Whether it's been in The Grinch, it's something happened at Christmas when the Grinch was a child, and that's why he hates Christmas. But it is in that interrogation of the world as we see it that suddenly the flaws in the model start emerging. And when I think about the ESG brand work, that's where you realize that a lot of the inequality in the system of hiring is just down to the status quo.
Is that the monster? So is status quo the monster?
The monster is assumptions we make, the biases that exist, the status quo, the fact that we haven't changed necessarily how the resume works as a technology. If you think about the resume as a technology, it's just a story. And what people look for to evaluate the story is, did they go to a good college? Did they work in a big organization? It tells us little or nothing about the skills of that individual. And so we just accept the resume as a technology we use to hire people. And yet, is that the best story to find out if this person is the right fit for my yoga, or that is it the right ad, I should say, as well? Like the idea of culture fit is another story we tell, but it's just a way of protecting the ins from the others. Whereas culture ad is, that's a shift in mindset, isn't it? If you bring somebody to add to your culture, I think that's really interesting. So that's when you realize that the monster is something slightly different, and we have to deal with the new knowledge, then we need to move to resolving those things for good. So if the world as we have seen it for years is flawed, and we realize that because there is this challenge to our thinking, how do we fix it for the future? And I think that's where the best ESG storytelling happens, where we think about a future of work with those things fixed. What is a better technology for hiring than the resume? How do we do job descriptions better? How do we make our hiring process less onerous that gets to the skills, and tell people what a vision of that might look like? Because so often we, as organizations, leave it to the audience to assume the result of our information, for them to picture what we mean. And yet an audience needs to see it. You have to be able to give them, nobody's going to follow you on the yellow brick road if you don't tell them where they're going. You have to tell people where they're headed, give them a vision that they can attach themselves to. And, you know, we go back to politics. I mean, that's what a lot of the best, most persuasive politicians do. It's not always for good, but they can talk about a world where the problems that you face today are fixed to get your votes. The dark arts may be described as sometimes.
Yeah, that'll be a different episode that we do then, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so story discipline isn't just a notion of hammering the same message. What you're talking about is that complex process that needs to happen in the inquiry and in defining those core pieces that you mentioned. And then it's consistently being able to talk about that story across in all the different ways.
Right. One of the things that I got frustrated with in PR was this need to have key messages, like a listing of key messages, without understanding the complexity of the story we're trying to tell and its multifacetedness and bringing in characters and emotion and situations and conflict. And I think intuitively, some of the best PR people I've known were able to do that. But in general, key messages, core messages, once they meet the world, they fall away very, very quickly. And you've seen, I mean, the best example, most recent example was Linda Yaccarino at the Code conference, the new CEO of Twitter. She arrived on that stage with her key messages and was confronted with questions that didn't fit the messages, and she didn't have the story to rely on. And that's where it got, I don't know if you've seen it, but it went awry a little bit for her there.
So expand on that just as an example, just to sort of deconstruct it. So this is Linda Yaccarino, who'd come in as the new CEO of X Twitter. When you looked at that, what were the key messages that she had in her mind, and how did this actually play out?
I think the best example is that, to me, her key message was, it's a new day at X. And what the interviewer wanted to know was, how are you changing Twitter X from what it used to be and the challenges it faced? And she was not willing to, and we go back to Act One, talk about the history of the organization and the current challenges it faced for a new dawn. And because you couldn't go back in time, because the messages were moving ahead, it's X now, that's where it all went awry. Because as an audience and as humans, we need to know the past, the present, and the future to fully understand the story. And if you're not going to do it, you look either inauthentic or you're hiding something. The story is not complete. We don't believe you, and you lose people. So I think that's, again, going back to the story discipline, it's like, unless you know the beginning, middle, and end, you're just going to be talking at people and you're not going to persuade.
Yeah, and I reflect on a lot of what you're saying. I look at a lot of times sort of what agency deliverables are in a brand process. It's, okay, what's that core brand narrative and manifesto? And then it's, okay, now we need to build a messaging matrix. When I think about those deliverables, they feel very disconnected from what you're actually saying that brands actually need.
Yeah. I mean, a messaging house looks great on the slide.
So what should replace it? And maybe sort of put a bow on this for us by talking about that, the past, present, and future story in Indeed's context. Like, how does this work in, instead of having the messaging matrix at Indeed, what do you have at Indeed that ties all of this together as a, so we can have a parallel?
Yeah, and I think that that is core to it. I think you have to begin, I mean, a new brand platform has to begin with the messaging house to get clarity about, okay, what does success look like? I think the next stage of that is to build a story for each of those messages, say. And it doesn't have to be long, but it has to be run through the mill of the three acts. And then you can find out, okay, there's a gap between. So I'll give you a specific example. We're doing this work now with our skills-based hiring narrative. And so traditionally, what you would do is get your slide together, get your messaging house, and what we want to say about skills-based hiring. And what we're doing now,
skills-based hiring, just define and in contrast to what?
Right. So skills-based hiring is essentially hiring people for the skills they have rather than just the experience. So it's not looking at the university as a proxy for skills or the company you work for as a proxy, but actually hiring skills first, which will help a lot of the job seekers who face barriers get hired, because it's about looking at transferable skills. So you may have worked in one industry. Are you a fit for a new industry? So it's getting out of the box of thinking that it has to be the university and the organization as a way of establishing, evaluating talent. That has a history outside of the organization. So what is the story of skills-based hiring outside of Indeed? What is the story of how we're approaching that subject matter? And you're getting these things down and then seeing, is there a gap between the cultural discourse and what we're saying? And then trying to fill that narrative out and fitting Indeed into the meta narrative is what people talk about, which is the story that's being told without you outside of your organization. And it is through that work that you can fit in the fill in the gaps of the story you're trying to tell, but also then when you're out there in the wild trying to lead or build yourself a thought leadership platform, then you really have the raw materials to be effective in any interview situation, in building any sort of credibility on the subject matter. And so that's a lot of discipline. It takes a long time, but we're doing that work. And what will come out of it then is a very tight three-act structure of the story, but it has gone through a whole lot of research and development to get to that point.
So when you then connect that up to even the broader brand purpose at Indeed, what is that? What's that overarching story?
The world can work better is the overarching story, right? So you can see, even just as I say that, the story of being told clicks in completely. I've told you a whole lot of storytelling about how we're getting to that point. But if we're saying, indeed, we believe the world can work better and it can work better through these ways. So when you think about that concept and that conceit of the world can work better, you have to understand why we work the way we do, what forces for change are operating in this moment, whether it's remote work, whether it's equitable hiring, equitable work, whether it's the pandemic. All of these forces are playing out, and who gets to shape that future? And that's one of the things as well. We need to talk about who gets to tell the story of the future we're going to experience. And so we need to bring in as many voices and as many perspectives in that clash of ideas right now, and then be able to paint a picture of those forces sort of brought together for good. And we need to show vision. Indeed's job is to show these visions of the future of work and the world working better. So that's it. To me, is a very large and varied platform for storytelling as a brand concept.
And then when we connect it to the equity piece, you talked earlier about the barriers to work. You talk about one. Can you just sort of outline, talk more about what those barriers to work are and what are the things, what are the sort of storytelling or things that you're doing as a way to bring to life Indeed's role in helping to drive that change?
Yeah, I mean, there's a multitude of barriers preventing people from work, but the four that we look at at Indeed are criminal records, fair chance hiring. That's
fair
one.
Fair chance hiring?
Which is fair chances is ensuring that more people with criminal records can get hired. Right? So being a fair chance hire is saying that we have, whether it's background checks or the way the hiring system works, ensuring that you're allowing as many people with criminal records. I mean, one in three Americans have contact with the justice system in the US. And so there's a huge amount of people who are prevented from getting back into the workforce because they have had encounters with law enforcement. And so we're trying to figure out ways to influence more employers to be a fair chance hire. The second then is skills-based hiring. And it's both helping people without college degrees get hired, because there's a huge amount of jobs that list a degree requirement that the job itself doesn't need a degree. Right? So, and that's because one of the things we do with job descriptions is just put in these things like strong communicator or degree required without thinking, just as proxies for whether this person's talented or not. So trying to challenge those assumptions. And then there is disability and ensuring that compliance is not just about meeting the bare minimums, but also providing information about the accommodations you're making and making sure that more people with seen or unseen disabilities are applying to your jobs. And then veterans, which is specifically in the US, making sure that people who are transitioning out of the military with a huge set of skills are encouraged to apply for jobs in civilian jobs. So, and then the core of all of that storytelling is telling the story of real people, real experiences, making people understand and build empathy with the people who experience those stories. I say it a lot. You know, Stalin is quoted as saying that the death of one man is a tragedy and the death of 1,000 is a statistic. And so by individuating people's stories and giving people characters or people they can root for, you're building empathy with your audience. But also then having the data, ensuring that we have interesting data points to point to the flaws in our thinking. And then always ensuring that we have a set of actionable things that employers can do, whether it's applying a fair chance filter to their job, listing their accessibility accommodations in their job descriptions, or removing degree requirements from jobs that don't need a degree, making sure that those actions are clear and then advocating and persuading employers to adopt them.
For a lot of brands in that moment, they would be the ones telling that story. But one of the things I love about your approach is through collaborations, that story is actually told by those individuals through the Film Fund. Can you talk a bit about that, both a bit about what that initiative is and what core principles that connects to that really any brand can learn from and apply?
Yeah, so Rising Voices is a film investment program that we've been running. We've just launched season 4, and it's in collaboration with the Emmy Award-winning producer Lena Wei and her production company Hilmengrad. And what we have done each year is opened applications to BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color filmmakers to send us scripts for short films around the future of work. And each year we get upwards of 1,000 applications. We read through every script and then we choose 10 and give them $100,000 to make their short film. And then we debut it at the Tribeca Film Festival. And I think that goes back to the core principle of who gets to tell the story. You know, I think of Rising Voices as a listening exercise. So we ask BIPOC community to tell us what their vision for the future of work is. We choose the scripts that connect with us. And actually, one of the principles that we ensure is that it's not us choosing the scripts, that we have our inclusion groups who represent within Indeed the BIPOC community, and they select the scripts that are most meaningful. And then we step away. And what's the hardest thing I had to fight for in Indeed was that brand don't get to give notes beyond the script. Once we choose the scripts and it goes in production, we do not give notes until it hits the screens at Tribeca. And that's why I talk about it as a listening exercise, because not all of the films are congratulatory or happy or celebratory about work. A lot of them are portents for a future we want to avoid, whether it's dislocation, isolation, climate change, fear, racism. They confront real subject matter. And I think both for the filmmakers, it's an opportunity to show they can work straight away in Hollywood. And a lot of them have gone on to direct Netflix shows and to make films for Disney Plus and to turn their shorts into feature films. But also that who gets to tell the stories matters. And so we could go in and hire our usual directors and make films about criminal records or about disability. But unless the community tells those stories themselves and feature their characters and feature their stories, it's not going to have the same impact. And so Rising Voices began as an innovation within the organization, and now it's become a fully fledged program. And also we're learning about what the future of work could be through this, and also the future of work we need to avoid through this program. So it has been incredibly meaningful.
So it's helping inform the strategy. It becomes a listening exercise. There must be a real delicate balance in then how you also think about how do you take this and connect it to, I don't know, driving some brand attribution or ensuring that it drives some type of brand lift. How do you go about that strategy and even measuring if that's part of it?
Yeah, so we have the usual brand metrics around the assets that we promote as part of the program. So whether it's UAC or brand reputational metrics, we track all of those.
UAC, just in case someone doesn't know
that. Oh, so unaided consideration. So what job board comes to your mind? And if they say Indeed, that's great. An unaided consideration point. And so we track those. But also the program itself is a job creation engine. So we track what has happened from the ideas that talent is universal, opportunity is not. What happens, we can provide opportunity. The program itself has created over 2,000 jobs for cast, crew, and associated people in the project. So that's showing that opportunity has a butterfly effect. We also have seen close to 100 film festival selections for these films. So they go on and have an afterlife from the program. And I think the real story then becomes what happens to the 30, we've 30 filmmakers go through the program, what happens to them post Rising Voices? And so the conceit was by giving opportunity to talent from these communities that they will change Hollywood from the inside. And I think we're just at the beginning of that story. But when you see them showing up on these big streaming platforms, when they're getting funding for feature films, when they're directing commercials for the likes of Jeep, when they're directing music videos for famous artists, suddenly you're saying, okay, well, the idea of this program was to show what we think and believe as an organization, and it is proving to be that case.
I imagine there's also there's a connection to internal pride, engagement, recruitment, retention as well that this can play into.
Oh, for sure. And even the selection of the films were shown at our marquee client conference, indeed Futureworks. And so it's amazing how these assets show up both internally, externally. You know, our GVP of ESG, LaFawn Davis, is going to the Lesbians Who Tech conference in San Francisco. And what she's going to be presenting on stage is Rising Voices films that feature LGBTQ issues. And we're going to have some of the directors there to speak on stage. So the assets that we're creating and the story behind the program itself is fueling all of these other initiatives across the business. And so then you're saying, well, the investment looked big at the start, but suddenly it becomes almost cost neutral when you can use it in all these different areas of the business. And I think that, again, is like, that's what great storytelling does. It can be used in all these different areas because it has those. It's not just a brand spot, a closed message. It lives on in all these different ways and has all these different ways in and can be adapted to different audiences. And even in the last couple of months, we took Rising Voices to TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival. We launched a mentorship program associated with Rising Voices in Canada. And so the story grows and expands as a result of just having that story discipline.
It's a wonderful case study. One of the things that we talked about in our earlier conversations, you said something that I thought was really fascinating. You said that we obsess about marketing in our own marketing circles. Talk about what you mean by that and the importance of a cross-disciplinary approach.
Yeah, I've been in marketing for 10, 11 years, and I'm still confused when I go on. People have such strong perspectives about the marketing discipline. And whether it's performance or brand or short-term versus long-term activation, the triple threat of attention. And I think all of those principles are really important. But sometimes we lose sight of the impact we are having as an industry on the wider populace. And sometimes I feel like we need to get back to, is the work creating a good? Are we advancing each other by pushing this work out into the world? And there are times when I see case studies on effective marketing and marketing effectiveness. And to me, it's not producing good in the world. It may be effective, but over time, do you want to sit back as a marketer and say, well, I had a positive impact on the way people see the world, or did I just make a lot of money for the organization? And I think that's the conflict I find myself having sometimes. And also, it goes back to Orlando Wood talks about it in his book, Lemon, but he references Ian McGilchrist, the master and his emissary. I think we have been, even in the last 20, 30 years, we've become so obsessed with data because we have access to so much data. It leads what we create. And we have forgotten that there's a greater whole. There's a greater picture. We're part of something bigger. We're part of a society. And I think it leads to both a lack of creativity is maybe the best way I could describe it, or an ethos of pushing creativity further and expanding our creative expression, trying new things, I think making mistakes with marketing. And I think we need to get back to that idea of creativity being the fullest expression of our humanity, which may sound like a lot of BS, but to me, I'm exploring constantly how we can be more creative. How can we try things? How can we get back to that childhood need for newness, delight, new ideas versus just internalizing our belief system, sticking to our one story and then expecting different results from that process?
You clearly get a lot of your inspiration and source of knowledge from a lot of different places. How do you stay current today? Are you connected into different networks? Are there peers of yours at other organizations that are doing similar things? Like, how do you stay fresh and keep abreast of sort of what's going on?
So I order way too many books on Amazon. So I have a ritual where I read a fiction book and a nonfiction simultaneously. And also I have nonfiction on my desk and I'll have my fiction novel at night and I'll read both. I'll make sure I read at least a certain amount of pages a day. And I think constantly upgrading your operating system is important. And then following the likes of Orlando Wood or Mark Ritson or Peter Field on LinkedIn and following their conversations and their arguments is a good way of like challenging your assumptions constantly. And then we've never had so much opportunity to learn for free as we do right now, whether it's what podcast you're listening to. So I would religiously listen to The Daily. And if you talk about storytelling, the New York Times are the preeminent storytellers, the way they are able to serve up complexity and issues through the various medium. I think they're amazing at that. And from an interviewer perspective, Michael Barbaro on The Daily Show, he asks the dumb questions so you don't have to feel stupid, which I think is just a beautiful idea as an interviewer. And then you'll find that if you're following all of those conversations, then that they will lead you to the source material that you need to upgrade yourself with. And I think that is, to me, is just to continually follow, take notes, understand the reference points, consume them, take what you want out of them, leave the stuff that doesn't connect, and start building a more complex picture of the world through that discipline. And so I hope that answers your question. But some of it is just habit forming, and other is just staying open and curious and challenging your belief system constantly.
Aidan, thank you so much for the time today. This has been an incredibly insightful conversation on a really important topic, and hopefully everyone who's listening to this will learn a lot from it.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Gabriel. I've really enjoyed it.
Cheers.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.